But let's go, if we could, to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. If you're new to the class, lots of times we will cover some of the passages in the scriptures, and if we have some time at the end, as you can see in your handout, I want to get into a couple of those, but if not, we'll postpone those to next week. But we're coming into a passage now where Paul wants his readers to really know the value and appreciate once again the value of the gospel. And he presents the value of the gospel in three different ways. First of all, that the content, not the delivery, is what makes the message special. Again, in Corinth, they would have all these traveling speakers, and a lot of them were gifted in rhetoric, but he's saying it's not whether or not you are a great communicator, it's the message you are communicating. Number two, even though the world brings pain, he wants to help them understand in the midst of some of their suffering that it also brings hope and healing. And then finally, Paul shows us that we don't lose heart, as we'll see in chapter 4, beginning. And then the last part of chapter 4, he says this two different times, I do not lose hope. Now think about the person who says, I do not lose hope. He has gone through a very tumultuous time with his church. By this time in which he's written this, he's been shipwrecked, he's been beaten, he was left for dead. He has been essentially persecuted beyond measures any of us could possibly imagine. And he says, I don't lose hope. Really? Think about that for a minute. Well, because of the resurrection, because our value is in God and not in us. So let's look at the first six verses in chapter 4 and start in verse 1. Therefore, having this ministry by the mercy of God, we do not lose heart. But we have renounced disgraceful and underhanded ways. We refuse to practice cunning or to tamper with God's word. But by the open statement of the truth, we would commend ourselves to everyone's conscience in the sight of God. And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled only to those who are perishing. In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For what we proclaim is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, with ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, let light shine out of darkness, has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Real quickly, let's, if we can, cover some of those issues. And first of all, he talks about the fact that he is preaching the gospel not because he's receiving compensation, as some of those traveling speakers who are gifted in rhetoric are receiving, but instead he's talking about the blessing that really outweighs all the struggles and difficulties and challenges he's facing. The struggles were real, if no other reason. One that I listed right there is just the sheer discouragement of trying to establish a church in Corinth, then having so many difficulties, having to write what was called the severe letter, having to tell them to correct individuals in the congregation, and now finally coming and writing this final letter that we are seeing. So that was enough. But even more so, you have these adversaries inside the church and outside the church that were leveling all sorts of accusations against him and saying that he was using the gospel for his own purposes. You know, he's just in it for the money, if you will. And the members of the church in Corinth didn't even defend him. See, can you imagine how discouraged you'd be? Your motives are pure. You have sacrificed greatly for this church. Then you are attacked, and nobody comes to your defense. Can you imagine what that must have felt like? I'm sure we've all had that. And so then he raises this question about, well, have we really tampered with the gospel? And that actually is a Greek word that only appears in the New Testament. It appears nowhere else in the Bible. But if you go to ancient literature, that same Greek word that we translate to tamper with was used when they talked about diluting wine. If you'd come over to a wedding and we were running a little low on wine, they'd add water to it and hand it out at the wedding ceremony as a result so that they could keep it going a little bit longer. And what he's saying is, we're not diluting the Bible. We're not trying to compromise the Bible with the culture. And sadly, of course, we have various churches and even Christian organizations sometimes in the past, even today, that do that. And he's saying, that's not what we're doing. We're not diluting the Bible any more than we would be diluting the wine, if you will. And so then he begins to defend himself against this accusation. He said, I have no need to tamper with the gospel in order to make it more palatable because, after all, I'm not seeking the admiration of individuals. I think we're all aware of some churches that kind of downplay certain messages. They don't talk about sin. They don't talk about repentance. They don't talk about judgment. Why? Because they want to make sure they can fill the coffers. And I sometimes have people call on my radio show that will complain about those mega churches that are all seeker sensitive. I go, whoa. I go to a mega church and if anything, we preach the whole counsel of God. And I can mention lots of other Southern Baptist churches and lots of churches of other denominations that are still very large churches that are actually preaching the word of God, because he's preaching, as it says here, with boldness and openness. There's no secretiveness. There's no hidden agenda. There's no tampering. There's no deception. This is exactly what we're doing. And then finally, we come to the part where I just mentioned in our prayer. Last week, we talked a little bit about the gospel being veiled to the Jews. Now he's broadened it a little bit longer and saying, well, okay, if you're preaching the gospel, why isn't the church just full of members, right? Well, there's an answer, he says, and that is, even though I'm preaching with a gospel with openness and boldness, still people aren't believing, and that's because they are blinded. And if you've ever been involved in evangelism, I hope all of you will take the evangelism explosion course that we have here, or maybe we can go out and do some evangelistic opportunities. You know what it's like. You might as well be talking to the wall sometimes when you try to share the gospel. You do as best a job as you can, clearly sharing the gospel, and there's no impact. And what he says is that they have been we have actually found that the gospel is veiled, and it's veiled by what? The God of this world. Who is that? Satan and the evil powers. And so the gospel is veiled to them. What a great illustration. I mean, you go to Germany, you go to a lot of Europe, a lot of us have a chance to go over there occasionally and teach, and it is just amazing. This is where the Reformation took place. These are the countries where the Reformation spread, and yet you can go to Switzerland under John Calvin, and you can go to France under the teaching of the Huguenots. You, of course, go to Germany, the Lutherans, and there's just nothing. I mean, just this veil that is there. And so what a need for us to pray that God would remove those veils and pray for this seminary as well. And then finally, the gospel is, of course, his motivation. He preaches and works to advance the cause, not his own interest, as he talks in verse 5 there. And if nothing else, he serves the church. And I put down, if you're taking some notes, you might put down Matthew 25, verse 40. Just a kind of good place there, because he serves the church in Corinth, knowing that in so doing, he's serving the Lord. Just a reminder that when you're sharing the gospel, in a sense, you're sharing it as unto the Lord. As you are working tomorrow at your work or whatever you're doing it as unto the Lord. And it's just a reminder, once again, of the fact that we don't do it just for the adulation of the people around us, but ultimately, there is an audience of one, and it's God himself. And then, of course, the reason for this, he can't overstate, again, the salvation experience. We're going to look at that in just a minute. And then he talks about light to darkness. So he's quoting here from Genesis 1 just to use this idea that once a person comes from unbelief into belief, it's like a person coming from darkness into light, just like we went from darkness and then light through the creation. And so this, we begin to see this life-altering change that takes place. Next week, we're going to be looking in 2 Corinthians 5, and in verse 17, it talks about we become what? A new creation. And so again, it's an understanding of the remarkable change that takes place. And sometimes as we've heard some of these testimonies, even here in the church, we recognize again what God can do in an individual life. Let's pick up now in verse 7 and finish off the chapter. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not driven to despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying in the body the death of Jesus so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies. For we who live are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our mortal flesh. So death is at work in us, but life in you. Since we have the same spirit of faith, according to what has been written, I believed and so I spoke, we also believe and so also speak, knowing that he who raised the Lord Jesus will raise us also with Jesus and bring us with you into his presence. For it is all for your sake, so that as grace extends to more and more people, it may increase thanksgiving to the glory of God. So we do not lose heart. Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light and momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. A lot of famous passages here in 2 Corinthians 4 and 2 Corinthians 5, a lot of ones we've memorized if you've done Bible memory, but he starts out with this idea of jars of clay. Whenever you hear that now, you think of a Christian band, don't you? You know, jars of clay. And here he uses this metaphor to really help them understand that something that had relatively little value, which almost was worthless, is nevertheless holding something of great treasure. And to really understand that, you've got to understand that in that day you had some very nice goblets and vases. And if you've ever gone to a museum, some of us have been to Israel, some of us have been to Germany, you've gone through some of those and see those. But the day-to-day earthenware, frankly, was just fired mud. You know, you get the mud, you put it together, you put it in, it would heat up enough, and then you would drink into it. And so there were very inexpensive. They were earthen, probably got a little dirt, dust occasionally with it when you were drinking it. And if you'd ever drop one, they were just worthless. They were, you know, you drop another cup, you know, even had a dent, you'd keep using it. And so what he's trying to say here is something which, if you think about it, is kind of unworthy. He's going to talk about next week the fact that we have these earthly tents. You know, tents are pretty transitory as well. But nevertheless, those things, these jars of clay, hold something very great, and that is your precious spirit and the gospel itself. So again, this is the idea that we want to see that salvation is God, not from men, that we don't bring it, but it's the gospel that comes through us. Then he uses a great series of illustrations, and it wouldn't be a good Kirby Anderson chart talk without at least one chart. So here's my chart here, an attempt to take verse 8 and explain it a little bit more. And that is, on the left-hand side, I put the human limitations, and on the right-hand side, I put God's enabling. And so again, if you want to write this down, but again, I might just mention at the bottom of your handout, for those of you that are new to the class, you can go and find all of this on the website, PrestonWeExamined.org. But notice how he takes each one of these problems and then shows how God's enabling answers it. Afflicted in every way, verse 8, but not crushed. So he was afflicted, but he was not crushed. Number 2, perplexed, but not driven to despair. You know, he could have been easily crushed by all the weight that was on him. That idea, crushed, is like that same Greek word from which you like crush what? Grapes. Or you would crush olives. You crush grapes by using your feet. You crush the olives in a different way because you have to have a stone. And so obviously those are the ideas. But again, he must have been perplexed because he thought he was supposed to go in one direction, and then he has the Macedonian vision and God takes him instead to Philippi, all the way down to Corinth and Athens. So perplexed about where God might be leading him. Persecuted, certainly that relates because they were facing persecution in this outpost in the Hellenistic Greek world. But even though persecuted, not forsaken, God still knows that you were being persecuted. And then finally, struck down, but not destroyed. There were times when, yes, Christians were struck down. They weren't just persecuted, they were struck down. There was a loss of some individuals in the church. There was the loss of some churches that were struck down because the persecution was so great they did not meet or they had to flee, but again, not destroyed. And for those of us that sometimes wonder, what's God doing in the world? Isn't this a great chart? Just my attempt to try to help you put some of those phrases, those contrasts there in verse 8. Let's go on then, and he also talks about the fact that he suffered not only physical suffering, we saw that in the first chapter, but a little bit later also psychological affliction. I'm not sure which is worse, physical suffering or mental or emotional suffering. I don't recommend either, but he encountered both, as we will find as we get to chapter 7. And so he's experienced all sorts of hardship. It would have been easy for Paul to say, you know, I've done my best. I've been and planted these churches. Time for somebody else. Next, I'm going to pull somebody in from the bullpen. And hopefully he had a better bullpen than the Rangers have these days. But nevertheless, you know, bring somebody else, you know, my time is done. But no, he's still there. And so he says, in a sense, really, my life is kind of a mixture of death and life. The idea that he carries around death, in one sense, he's talking about, I feel the death of Christ because I'm facing the suffering that comes. You know, I could have just been a rabbi. I could have just been a Pharisee, a student of Gamaliel, and I would have done just fine. And I would have been lauded, and I would have been honored, and I would have been invited to the choice banquets. But instead, I saved myself. But I was saved, and once now I have accepted Jesus Christ, and now I'm a disciple of Jesus Christ, I face all the suffering. My life sure would have been easier if I hadn't been saved. But now that I am saved, look what I'm encountering, and it's really difficult. But nevertheless, he's saying, even though I have the feel of death of Christ upon me, nevertheless, I'm spiritually alive. And really, this duality he's trying to communicate is really the theme of 2 Corinthians, as we've said before. Comfort in the midst of suffering. And so he says in verse 12 that the more he suffers, what he calls the death at work in us, the more divine comfort he receives so that he can then what? Pass it on to the other church in Corinth. Kind of hard to look at that way. Lord, bring me suffering so that I can feel that comfort so then I can comfort others. If you really want that prayer, you know, I'm going to turn you to it. But nevertheless, that's exactly what he's really describing as the fact that the way he provides comfort to them as an individual has been comforted in the midst of his own suffering. So finally, you might say, what enables him to continue ministering even in the face of death? And we've got a couple of answers. First, we see this in verse 13. If you look in verse 13, we say that he says we have the same spirit. He expresses the belief in the gospel so that he can share it because faith cannot remain unvoiced. I think one of the indications, sometimes we have real questions as to whether or not somebody's saved. And I think at least one good test, the Bible doesn't really give us a test on how we always determine it, but of course, do you show the spiritual fruits is one. But I found that if a person has become a Christian and they really are born again, they can't really keep it to themselves. They want to share their faith. And so here he's saying, you know, faith cannot remain unvoiced. And second, he continues to preach through suffering because he's convinced that the resurrection of Jesus Christ guarantees the resurrection of the believer at the end. Now, the Corinthians, of course, in church in Corinth there, really experienced the benefits of his suffering, and they matured and then were able to minister to others. So he is seeing that as you actually give this faith to faithful men, that you entrust it to them, that they will teach others also. So he's seeing that takes place. And that's why he says, I do not lose hope. I do not lose heart. Instead, even though I'm wasting away, Paul was probably a shell of the former rabbi and Pharisee that he was. Recognize he has been beaten. Recognize that he is much older. He's got a lot of road wear because he has walked all over Asia Minor. As well, of course, we know that he had an affliction. Some people think it may be in his eyesight or something else. So he is certainly wasting away. And sometimes we get up in the morning, look in the mirror, go, can we reshuffle the deck here? You know, we need a makeover here. You know, so those of us in here recognize that in some respects, physically, we're going downhill and not able to do all that we can. But he says, even though physically I'm wasting away, spiritually I'm growing stronger. What? Day by day. The Christian life is to be lived day by day. And so we really depend upon the Lord's strength day by day. Then he takes us in verse 17 and 18 to talk about how he has an eternal perspective. Those of you that went through our Bible study last fall, we talked about how important it was to have this eternal perspective. You read through the Periscope book, and the first seven chapters were all about having an eternal perspective, and they were based upon these verses. And he says, you know, what we have seen, you know, the struggling, the strife, the suffering, all the earthly power, that's what's seen. And in some respects, that holds our attention because that's what we see every day. He says the true reality is what is unseen. And when what is unseen holds our attention and our focus, then the suffering and trials and hardship actually begin to fade away. And so it's really important sometimes to recognize that even though we see a world that seems like it's in chaos and the midst of despair, and we may not feel the kind of despair that they feel right now in the Bible seminary there in Bonn, Germany, but you can imagine sometimes just saying, you know, God, where are you in the midst of all of this? We have to recognize that when we look at those things which are unseen, then we will not lose hope. Well, next week we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about even how he applies that in the first couple of verses of chapter 5. But I thought that what I might do today is, since we do have a little bit of time here at the end, is spend a little bit of time talking about, last week we talked about the covenants, but this week I had a chance to interview Ed Heinsohn, and he and Tommy Eisen. Ed Heinsohn is the dean at Liberty University. And this book I thought was so well done because it's titled Charting the Bible Chronology, A Visual Guide to God's Unfolding Plan. And what I wanted to do is show you some of the diagrams which might help you understand what we talked about last week in terms of the covenants. Then we just briefly mentioned dispensations, and I found that afterwards I had as many questions after I tried to answer the questions as I had before. So I'm going to try to see if we can answer those as well. But a lot of this comes from this book, which is very well done. First of all, you're going to recognize that this is really sort of like almost a coffee table kind of book that has all sorts of great diagrams and charts. Matter of fact, it even has this incredible fold-out chart for the entire Bible, which is amazing to me. And I wanted to mention it, one, because you might want to have one on your coffee table, but also it's graduation time. And I thought this might be a great, you know, graduation present. I mean, I'm getting a commission on it, but after I found this book, I said, this is going to answer all the kind of questions that I got last week, because each one of these diagrams might help put it in a little better perspective. So again, I've taken the diagrams from this book and thought I would use this for a few minutes to, first of all, reinforce what I did last week on the covenants. And then for those of you that weren't here last week, you can kind of learn again. We'll go through that fairly quickly, show how that fits with the dispensations and then also the feasts of Israel. And I think I've left myself enough time to do so. So what we're going to do is we're going to start working here. First of all, we're going to, this is the other thing I like. They got a timeline down here. So there's Adam all the way to, then you get to where Moses is in the exile, all the way to the church and the kingdom. And then you got, you know, the Adamic covenant, the Abrahamic covenant, the Mosaic covenant. And you begin to see how they all come together and they find their fulfillment either in the church or in the next age. So what we want to try to do is see if we can kind of summarize this idea of covenants. And again, if you weren't here last week, the reason we covered a lot of this is because those were the Ask Kirby questions. So let me try to go back and summarize those again. Most theologians believe that there are seven specific covenants in the Bible. Now, what's a covenant? Well, a covenant's like a contract. And so some can be general in nature, but then you also have some that are conditional. And we will see a few of those. If you obey, then you're going to receive the benefits. If you disobey the requirements, then the covenant is broken. That's a lot like most of the contracts that you have signed, or maybe even contracts that you issue. But then we also see that in the scriptures, especially in Genesis and the Abrahamic covenant, for example, and the Davidic covenant, God actually has an unconditional covenant. It's no strings attached. Whether you obey or disobey, this is my guarantee to you, Abraham, and to the nation of Israel. So let's look at those real quickly. The first two that happened before the flood, I'm going to put those together. Last week we broke them out, but in the interest of going through all of this, we can see that first of all, there's the covenant that God has with Adam, and that is a general covenant. And you find that in Genesis 1 and in Genesis 2. And so this is really the provision ultimately for, even after the fall, man's redemption, because we see this in Genesis 3 verse 15. Well, then you have all the patriarchs living, and this is something else that's really interesting here. If you look at the ages of the patriarchs, you realize that the flood does not take place until after Methuselah dies. You also realize that Adam was alive when Methuselah was alive. When you see all of this in the timeline, you begin to realize something you never really thought about before, because these people are living a long period of time. So that's kind of fascinating to look at as well. But then after the flood, God has removed the evil, and now he makes a covenant with Noah and his family. And this is a result of the fact that I will never once again destroy the world through a flood. And we see this in Genesis 9, but it's also repeated again in 2 Peter, because the sign of that covenant is what? It's the rainbow. So when you see the rainbow, think of Noah, not of something else, okay? Just a thought there, okay? So then, let's get to the ones that are going to be more important, and that is you have the Abrahamic covenant. And this is an unconditional covenant. If you've heard Joel Rosenberg speak in the church service, or if you've heard Gary Fraser speak here, we talk about this was a covenant between God and Abraham, but it's an unconditional one. And we'll get into the land covenant in just a minute. And so that's why, as we showed in that diagram just a minute ago, this covenant goes all the way to the future millennial kingdom. And there's a place still for God with the Jewish people. We see this during the book of Revelation and during the tribulation and all the rest. And it's, again, a promise that the world would be blessed through Abraham. And those who bless Abraham will be blessed. And those who curse Abraham and the Jews will be cursed. Now, there was also, while all sorts of other things were happening, this was a busy week. It's what do you call talk show gold? Because not only did we have, you know, all the things going on with the National Day of Prayer and the Religious Liberty Executive Order, and, of course, an up or down vote on whether or not to repeal and replace Obamacare, but you also had this Israel summit that was taking place as well. And so that was very significant as well, and many of the leaders were there with talking about, again, the importance of the nation of Israel and why we as a nation want to continue to bless the nation of Israel. Well, related to this is what is oftentimes seen as a second covenant. Some only say there's six covenants, some say seven. I'm going to talk about what most say, and that is there's another covenant, which is the land covenant, or the Palestinian covenant. You find that in Deuteronomy 30, and it said that we would scatter Israel, but because I had committed to you, even though there would be this diaspora, there would be a scattering of the Jews, there would be a time when they would come back to the land. You saw that in a limited sort of way when the southern kingdom was taken into exile into Babylon, but then under Ezra and Nehemiah and others came back. But I think the most significant one has happened. Of course, this is why they were gathering together, because this is the anniversary of, in May, 1948, the establishment of the nation of Israel. And so people believe that that is also a fulfillment of that covenant. So you can begin to see where we are in some of the covenants here a little bit. We talked about the Abrahamic covenant, the land covenant. Now we'll get to the Mosaic covenant, the Davidic covenant, and yes, we'll get to the New Testament here. Where are we there on that? Well, the first one is the Mosaic covenant is very familiar to us, because that's the law which extends all the way until we get to the time of grace. And again, it's a blessing for obedience and a curse for disobedience, which is why they were taken into exile. The evidence of that can be very easily seen in the Ten Commandments and in the 600 other laws that were part of that Mosaic covenant. And then you have the Davidic covenant. This was during the time of David, where again, it was an amplification of the covenant with Abraham, promising that David's family line would continue, that it would be a blessing to the world, and that's the line of what? Jesus, and that it would be an everlasting covenant, and the idea that when Jesus sits on the throne in Israel, that will be a fulfillment of that particular covenant. Make sense? Let's move on to the New Testament real quickly, because last week we looked at how the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians 3 spent some time talking about the Old and New Covenant, and he speaks about two covenants in Galatians and also in 2 Corinthians. We see this covenant described in Jeremiah 31, and promised that God would forgive sin and that there would be a close, unbroken relationship with his people. And so this was first made to Israel and then finally to all who come to know Jesus Christ. And so you can see this in Matthew 26 and then the fact that we're grafted in as Gentiles in Hebrews 9. So that gives you a little bit of a look at those covenants, but again, see how this runs from the Abrahamic covenant to the Mosaic covenant to the Davidic covenant. Now we're into the new covenant, which brings us into what? The church age, and we'll continue into the kingdom. But notice that all the way here, the Abrahamic covenant goes back because there's still a place for the Jews, and we'll see those in that millennial that will take place, the millennial kingdom. So a lot of people then say, okay, well then how does that relate to, I've been hearing this word dispensations, how does that relate? Well, covenants are relationships or treaties, if you will. Dispensations are how God progressively reveals himself through time. And so we can see that, first of all, these dispensations describe various stages of God's revelation over time. One of the people that most often has written about this when he was alive was Dr. Charles Ryrie. Some of you might remember when we went to the Museum of Biblical Arts, we had a lot of the display there from Charles Ryrie of all these Bibles. And he describes it as a stage in a progressive revelation in which it is being revealed to a particular nation or period of time. But you might say, where are you getting this word dispensation? Well, actually, from the New Testament. Various forms of the word dispensation show up 20 different times in the New Testament because it shows how God was revealing himself through history. And so we have certainly what's called the dispensation of innocence. That's what happens in Adam prior to the fall. They're in the Garden of Eden. There's total innocence. And so there's really only one covenant, and that is, do not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. How'd they do on that? Not so good. So now we move from the time of what's called the dispensation of conscience, which goes from the fall all the way to Noah's flood. Then after the time of the flood, we have the human government. We have, for example, in Genesis 9:6, the idea of capital punishment and the fact that government has the authority over individuals. Then from Abraham to Moses, we have what is called the promise. And then finally, of course, we have the law. And that's where we read primarily about in 2 Corinthians 3. And that goes from Moses all the way to the crucifixion. Then we are now in the period of grace. I usually say that the period of grace starts with the cross, but I notice this book starts in the day of Pentecost. But either way, from the time in which the church begins to the rapture, we're now in the period of grace, no longer under law. And then after the tribulation, there will be a 1,000-year reign under the millennial kingdom. So if you look at it that way, you can begin to see that we've covered all those various dispensations. But just since I have a few minutes left, let me take the third one real quickly, because some people say, okay, we've got covenants. Okay, Old Testament, New Testament, I got that. We've got different dispensations. But okay, you got these Jewish feasts. What's the purpose of all of those? And that's, again, each one of these is a chapter in the book. So again, if you want to know a little bit more, grab a copy of the book. There, and the feasts also point to that same direction in a third way, because the covenants are the treaties, the dispensations of the time. The feasts are those single particular activities that take place, and there, again, just as there are seven covenants and dispensations, turns out there's also seven feasts. And you can, if you want to take some notes or even turn to Leviticus 23, that's where we get these seven feasts. Now we have four of those feasts that take place in the spring. Passover, we see that in verse 5. Unleavened bread, we see that in verse 6. Then the Feast of First Fruits, verse 10 and 11. And then Pentecost, or sometimes it's called the Feast of Weeks, in 15 and 17. So those are all kind of munched together in the fall. Then we go through the summer, and then we have the fall one. So the spring are four, then the fall we have three. That is, you have the Feast of Trumpets, that's in verse 24, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, 27, and the Feast of Booths or Tabernacles, verses 39 to 43. Well, what this book does, and many people have said, is, wait a minute. We have a fulfillment in the first coming of Jesus in those four feasts in the spring. Think about this for just a minute. Because he fulfilled the four of those in the spring cycle. Now, the feasts are obviously to remind the people of the Abrahamic covenant. But again, let's back up for just a minute. Remember what those feasts are. First of all, when did Jesus actually have the Lord's Supper? Which feast was taking place? Passover. At the Passover, what did he pass around? Bread, unleavened bread. Okay, then in his resurrection, what was he? Paul tells us in Romans that he was the first fruits of the resurrection. Then what happened after that with the establishment of the church? The feast of what? Pentecost. So all four of those were fulfilled in the death, burial, resurrection, and establishment of the church. So this is why, let me go back now to this, others have said then that if those four feasts were fulfilled in what? Death, burial, resurrection, establishment of the church in the period of what's called grace, that's the dispensation of grace, then these three feasts will be fulfilled when Christ returns. What's the first one? Again, I'll put it back here so you can remember. That first one is the Feast of Trumpets. What will happen at the rapture? The trumpets. Now, some people put this at when Christ returns again. So I'm not going to get into the intramural debate as to whether or not the Feast of Trumpets is fulfilled with the rapture when Christ comes for his church or when Christ comes with his church. But first of all, those are the trumpets. Okay, at that point then you have what? The atonement that is now established for that 1,000-year period, the Day of Atonement, and then the establishment of the human government and the tabernacles. What was the tabernacles? Well, then that was where God came to earth in the tabernacle. You would go into the Holy Holies and God was there. Well, now God comes in the person of Jesus Christ and sits on the throne in Jerusalem. Does that make any sense at all? So I think if nothing else, you can kind of see why many people say, I think what we have here then is the fulfillment of Jesus in these four feasts in the spring at AD 33. And then we have these last three, which will be fulfillment in Christ's second comings. And if that doesn't encourage you, I don't know what else to say. EJ, you have it.